New Zealanders want and deserve a transparent and comprehensive inquiry into the COVID-19 response, not another whitewash. That's why RCR is bringing you a special segment aimed at examining the terms of reference, as well as what the country's best and brightest minds believe should be put on the table and why. The inquiry sessions will endeavour to unpack everything we already know and all the things we still don't know about how the COVID response was handled and what needs to be included in any new inquiry so that New Zealanders can get answers, justice and a future free from government overreach. Welcome to the inquiry sessions. Welcome to another edition of the Inquiry Sessions on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alastair Harding, and today on the Inquiry Sessions, I have the pleasure of introducing Canadian legal mind, Bruce Pardy. Bruce Pardy is the Executive Director of Rights Probe, a legal rights and freedoms research foundation based in Canada. He's also a professor of law at Canada's Queen's University, and he is a critic of legal progressivism and the expansive managerial state. And he has also written extensively on a range of subjects at the front lines of the culture war inside law. He's taught in Canada and the USA, as well as here in New Zealand, and he's one of the creators of the Free North Declaration, a call to arms to protect civil liberties in Canada from the irrational overreach of the COVID era. The reason I thought Bruce would be interesting to talk to today is because of the stunning parallels we often saw between New Zealand and Canada during the COVID era. Much of what went on in Canada also happened right here in New Zealand. Often we would see Justin Trudeau do something or say something, only to be closely followed by Jacinda Ardern doing almost exactly the same thing, only a short time later. Bruce Pardy is with us today to compare notes and discuss what we learned in our two countries during the COVID era. Bruce, welcome to the Inquiry Sessions on Reality Check Radio.
Alistair, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, to start with, what was your experience in the COVID era? What did you get up to during that time? And how has it affected what you do today?
Right. Well, you know, in a way, it's a bit of a paradox because in March of 2020, when the lockdowns first began, and they were, you know, they were said to be a, people remember the 2 week thing. They're 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Some of us said immediately, this won't do. This cannot happen. This is wrong. And we said that not because we had any medical information. We didn't, that was not based upon the idea that it wouldn't work. It was based upon the idea that you if you're living in a free country, you can't do that to people. You can't make healthy people stay in their homes by government edict. And it doesn't really matter what the problem is. So almost immediately we crossed a threshold. We crossed a threshold that if you had thought back to an earlier time, and not that much earlier, one would have expected people to say, oh, well, the government can't do that. And then suddenly they were doing it. And not only were they doing it, but the people, large numbers of people anyway, supported them in doing it and wanted more of it. As time went on and the 2 weeks passed, it really did seem like we were in a different era. And the world, in a way, had turned a corner and gone a little mad. On the other hand, and this is the paradox, on the other hand, a lot of the things we saw during COVID that seemed to be sort of extreme, sudden changes in normal, I think can be traced to trends that have been going on in our civilization for quite a long time. And in a way, the COVID overreach was a culmination of those trends. And so we really perhaps should not have been so surprised that what happened during COVID actually did happen, because you could characterize them as sort of the inevitable result of allowing certain ideas to gather steam along the way over a course of decades. And so if there's any silver lining to what happened during COVID, it was the realization of just how far we've come without realizing it, and how difficult it will be to either get back to somewhere, which I'm not sure is possible, but to go forward perhaps with clear eyes about the situation that we're in.
So where were we? How far had we come? is what we saw an aberration in the flow of history, or is the aberration actually that we have perhaps got comfortable enjoying such a long period of freedom, which in the context of history is actually unprecedented?
Yes, well, yeah, you make a very good point. Very good point. I mean, we, those of us who live in a Western nation, I think are apt to believe that the lives that are lived in Western nations, one of relative peace and prosperity and liberty, is the normal. But I take the point you're making, and I think it's valid, which is, if you take the long view of history, that is by far and away the exception, the aberration to the normal way that things usually are in human societies. I mean, human civilization is a history of tyranny and slavery and poverty and violence. And, you know, one of the things to be worried about in this time is that we are, that the window is closing on that aberration, and maybe we're going back to, and not in the same way, of course, everything is going to be different, but in the very general sense, going back to a period where all of those things, the prosperity, the peace, and the liberty, just aren't what we consider to be normal.
But we've also gone through that period of freedom, so we look at all of this through those lenses. But I've also heard you talk about a different way of looking at all of this. I've heard you say that many of us point to the evidence of the failures as proof of why those measures were wrong. But what you say is that that's a mistake. For example, that we need to acknowledge that the lockdowns weren't wrong because they didn't work. They were wrong because you can't lock people up in a free society. How important is that distinction as we sift through what went on?
Oh, I think it's crucial. Now, that is not to value the work that a lot of people are doing to explain the damage that these policies did, like the ones you allude to, you know, the harms caused by lockdowns to mental health, to children, to medical situations, the ways in which masks didn't work but probably caused more harm than good, the dangers posed by the vaccines, which weren't tested properly and had this danger and that danger attached to them. I don't think that that information is irrelevant, not by any means, but as you alluded to, that's not the reason that the measures were wrong. Because if you argue that vaccine mandates, for example, are wrong because the vaccines didn't work and they caused more harm than good, then what you're in danger of arguing is that the vaccine mandates would have been okay if the vaccines had been better and less dangerous. And that is basing the argument purely on the facts. And the case that I would make is that the medical and scientific facts don't matter. If we are in a position where we can lock people down, we can make them take a vaccine, we can make them wear a mask, as long as the facts are on our side, then we don't understand what liberty is. Liberty means that people have the right to make their own choices about medical treatments, about location, about what you put in your face, and they are allowed to take their own medical risks. And if we've taken that liberty away, then we cannot legitimately call ourselves a free society. We are now a technocratic society in which the technocrats' assessment of the evidence determines what it is that they can do. I remember hearing, I think it was an official in Britain, this is in retrospect, he said, but he was being interviewed and asked about the first lockdowns. And I remember him saying, you know, we wanted to do what China did, but we didn't think we could get away with it. And then the outbreak happened in Italy, in northern Italy, and that's what they did. And the people in Italy accepted it. And then we thought, you know, maybe we can do it too. And so they did it. And so they crossed this threshold. And if our only argument against that is that the lockdowns didn't work, then then for my money, we are a lost people.
Do you think there's an understanding of that dawning across the world yet? Or are we still, in the main, oblivious to it all?
I'm afraid that a lot of people are still oblivious to it. I find that a lot of people who were against the COVID overreach, who were against lockdowns, who were against vaccine passports, some of those people still think this way. And, you know, we have to understand why that is, because a lot of these people are scientific and medical people, and they're trained to look for data, and so they're accustomed to trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And so they may be attuned to evaluating a policy on that basis. And it's a little bit more difficult to reach a bit and understand that this is not a question of what the right policy would have been at a particular moment in time. The point is, there shouldn't have been a policy. If all we're talking about is whether or not the policymakers got the science right, then we have not, for my money, learned the lessons of COVID. And I think a lot of people have not gotten to that point yet, even the ones who were skeptical of the whole regime.
On the topic of the legal system, one of the people I've spoken to on the inquiry sessions is the world-renowned Danish researcher Peter Gürtcher, and he's pointed out the endless literature on the pointlessness of masks and lockdowns and the ineffectiveness of the so-called vaccines, also the sidelining of drugs like ivermectin. Yet our courts don't seem to take any of that literature or research into account when they make their decisions, and it's extraordinarily frustrating to watch when lawyers present evidence contrary to the government narrative, but then the courts seemingly don't take that evidence into account at all. They simply say, well, it's all in the public good for everyone to be vaccinated and it's safe and effective and all of that stuff, and we don't need to look at any contrary evidence because the government's already done that. And for those of us who question the official narrative, that's, as I said, extraordinarily frustrating because that evidence ends up never being tested. How can we change that? How can we actually get them to acknowledge at least that there is contrary evidence and get them to test it in a court of law?
I think we have to challenge the premises upon which we are now governed. The problem is that the basis of our legal system is not evidence, it's authority. And our administrative decision makers have an extraordinary discretion now to make decisions in the public interest. And that discretion is not dependent upon them showing their work. They don't have to show us that the decision that they made is based upon the evidence or the science, or that they did their figuring out properly. Their authority is based upon the fact that a statute has delegated that discretionary authority to them. And their legitimacy is not based upon the data. It's based upon the fact that Parliament passed a law that gave them the authority, period. And so a lot of people have been under the misimpression that if you march into a courtroom with scientific evidence that a policy is damaging, that a court's going to reverse it. And that has never been the case. Now, occasionally you'll find a statute that you know, provides conditional authority based upon certain things. And so you can attack a policy if those conditions are not there. But it very much depends upon what the statute says. As a general rule, statutes quite frequently give blanket discretionary authority to certain kinds of public officials to do what they think is best. And so when the courts are asked to review a decision of one of these people, the question is not, is the science right? The question is not, did the policy work? The question is, did the decision get made within the boundary of the authority that Parliament gave?
So in that respect, it's that expression we keep hearing, that law is downstream from politics and politics is downstream from culture. And so to change the law, we need to change the culture.
No question. No question. And you can see, so one of the many myths about how the legal system works is that courts are not affected by public opinion and they're not affected by, you know, cultural currents. Well, that's just clearly not correct. The answers that courts tended to give during this period, I found them shocking but not surprising. They're the kind of answers you would have expected, given the cases that were being brought. A lot of the cases that were being brought were losers from the beginning because the premises were wrong. Not all of them. Some of them were worth it. Some of them were definitely worth a crack. And we lost cases that we should have won. But a lot of cases were lost because they were loser cases. And because people thought that the government and the officials, the public health authorities, were obliged to do things they were not obliged to do. I think we have to back up and question the premises upon which we are governed. And one of those premises is that we have and need a managerial state to supervise, to direct, to control, to keep us safe. As long as you have that premise in place, the COVID regime is one of the kinds of things you're going to get almost by definition.
So perhaps is that what we've actually been asking for in the Western world, a managerial state?
Yes. Yes. So the administrative state, as it's sometimes called, has been with us for decades now, and people disagree about when it actually began, but it can be traced back to, you know, even around the time or shortly after the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, or perhaps around the time of the Great Depression, or certainly, you know, in the UK, for example, after World War II. But whenever it began, what we've got now, I'd be inclined to call a managerial society rather than an industrial one. We are a society in which the elites, if you like, are not the industrialists, but the people who manage. And when I say manage, I don't mean like a bank manager. I mean people who make the calls about how society is going to operate. And you might think of the government leaders of the day who run the party that has won the previous election. And sure, they're certainly part of it, but it's not just them. It's a whole machinery of administration. It's, if you like, the deep state. But it's not a situation where the people are being dictated to against their will. Because if you speak to somebody on the street and say to them, all right, well, you know, do you think that we should have a managerial government? Maybe government shouldn't be solving social problems. The response that you might get from this random person on the street would be, but what else is government for? Doesn't government exist to solve social problems? I mean, why is it there? And if that's the answer that you get, that's a good indication about why we are where we are.
So you mentioned the deep state there, and that's the sort of expression that the legacy media usually follows up with the words conspiracy theory.
Sure.
But when they do talk about deep state, they're talking about how seemingly all of these governments are working in lockstep to sort of reorder society.
Yes.
And we keep seeing these same laws being drafted by different governments. For example, in New Zealand, we've been talking recently about something we call the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, which is essentially the same, I understand, as what you have in Canada, your Bill C-18, both of which intend to force tech companies to pay legacy media for the links to their news stories. And it's the same in Australia, the EU, Indonesia, California, the list goes on.
Uh-huh.
Then there's the online harms bills that are being proposed everywhere to moderate so-called hate speech. We're seeing it here in New Zealand. You've got the C-63 bill there in Canada in the works. We've also seen recently the backlash to similar legislation in Ireland. So these similarities are real. How do you explain that without calling them deep state or conspiracy theories?
Yes.
How do we explain how all of these governments are attempting to pass the same legislation all at the same time?
No question. No question. Yes. So these are all very dark developments. I mean, the online harms bill, for example, that you cited is preposterous. There is a positive way to see all these developments, though, and I think it might be this way, and I don't know if this is right. But one way to see all of this, and maybe including COVID even, is to see that the elites of the world, and I'm going to use that term, it's a very vague term, and it itself sort of smells of conspiracy theory, but whoever they are, the elites of the world, we may be getting to a point where they feel like they are losing control. And part of the reason for that, frankly, is technology, internet, communication, and so on. If you think back a number of decades, the only real source of news for the population was a handful of television networks and a few daily newspapers. And if you didn't get your information from there, you wouldn't get it anywhere. Radio, TV, newspapers, that was it. And now we are all talking to each other about everything. And a lot of the information about COVID, a lot of what I would call the accurate, true information, did not come from legacy media. It came from very small channels of very smart people who were determined to talk to each other. And that is a threat, because now elites cannot control information. And if you look at all the legislation that you referred to, it is all about trying to shut that down. And so, yes, it looks as though the screws are tightening. On the other hand, the screws might be tightening because they might feel like they are losing control if they don't, which is a really great thing. So which way this is going to go, who knows? If these bills pass and they're planned out, that's a very, very bad thing. The online harms bill, for example, is an incredible violation of the very idea that you live in a country with free speech. And if the population goes along with it, and I fear that a good chunk of the population just might, that means they've been persuaded not to believe their eyes and ears about what is actually happening. And that's the danger. The danger here is that the population, and including during COVID, demonstrated how easily they can be manipulated. And so in a sense, the battle to manipulate and condition the population on the one hand, versus the race to make sure that we continue to communicate in a way that's not controlled by the powers that be.
It also makes me think, the way you say that it's a debate we need to have about whether we want to live as a society responsible for ourselves, or have our governments be responsible for us.
No question. Yes. And this is part of the persuasion and the manipulation, right? I mean, it's often been said that the more you are able to make your population dependent upon you, being upon the government, the more easily the population will go along with whatever the government says, because it will appear to be in their interests to do so. The more helpless you make the population, the more manipulative, the more they will be able to be manipulated, because they can't afford not to. So the more people, an exponential problem in a way, right? So the more dominant the managerial state becomes, the larger it gets, the more people who work for it or who are dependent on it, the less likely the people are to oppose it, because they all rely on it. And if they're not able to fend for themselves in any other way, you're going to get agreement. And we are getting to that point where there are too many interests, and now including mainstream media, as you refer to. The mainstream media appears to be on the same page. The mainstream media seems to agree that we must have an expansive administrative state to take care of us all. And and is willing to label people who disagree with that as conspiracy theorists. And they're not wrong. I mean, people who say we don't want an administrative state are heretics, because that's what we've had for a long time.
You touch on the media, and I do see the media as being largely complicit in enforcing the agenda and the narrative. But I also see this conundrum of sorts that we've learned through that complicity, just how important a free media is and just how important a world without censorship is. So I also flinch when I hear people talking about how we have to force the media to tell the truth. That to me is just censorship in another guise.
I totally agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And for some reason, we have taken on a wrong idea about what free speech is. For some reason, a lot of people seem to believe that if you are saying something, whether you're a newspaper or a radio station or writing something on X or saying it in a video, that you are obliged to tell the truth. Now, first of all, there's no such thing as that, because if there is, then the government will be defining what it is. So you can't have that. But even so, the idea that free speech depends upon truth is not what free speech means. And I think we have to change the default position. So the default position right now appears to be that you should be allowed to expect that what you hear is true. And if people don't tell the truth, then you've been done it wrong. I think the default ought to be the opposite. All of us as citizens ought to be going through life, hearing and watching with the presumption that whatever we hear could very well be false. And so to hear it with skepticism and to accept the role, the job of listening to enough things that we can make up our own minds about what is true. And if we accept that, then the fact that somebody's peddling a story, it's a narrative that's not really true, is like, well, okay, that's what people do.
I almost hear a silver lining in that we've actually become maybe better through this process. And you've already touched on this a short time ago, that the paradigm has changed. I always say that when the protesters turned up at Parliament here in New Zealand, that the media planted their half dozen cameras on the balcony and they thought that they could control the narrative that way. But the protesters literally turned up with thousands of cameras, and therefore the narrative was formed through those lenses instead of the media's.
Yes.
And perhaps they're struggling a little bit with that new paradigm,
yes,
with the new way that the media is actually formed, that the media is no longer the select group. It's actually all of us now.
Right.
It's everyone.
Right. No, exactly so. Exactly so. That's part of the way that the establishment loses control. Now, of course, that they're not going to take that sitting down, which is part of the reason for the legislation that you alluded to earlier. And that legislation cannot be allowed to succeed, because if it does succeed, it really will have the effect of chilling all of the good work that you're referring to. I mean, the details, I'm sure, are all different. But in our C-63, the online harms bill, there is a provision to make it possible to file a complaint with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. If you want to complain about something that somebody has said online that you regard as hateful speech, and they can do that for free without a lawyer, and the commission or tribunal might decide that your identity doesn't have to be released to the person you're complaining about, and if you are the target of that kind of complaint, you're going to have to hire your own lawyer. You're going to have to take the time and expense of defending yourself, and you could end up, if you lose, you can end up being docked $70,000 in total. And even if you don't lose, you know, it's a whole long ordeal. And so they're setting it up so that it is dangerous to say things that will be regarded as outrageous online.
Yeah, but surely that's not governable in the long term.
You'd like to think not, but we already have, I don't know about New Zealand, but we already have provisions in various places in provincial human rights codes, for example, that already say things that are outrageous. For example, there's a provision in the BC Human Rights Code that says you cannot make a public statement that discriminates. Yeah, you heard that right. You cannot make a public statement that discriminates. Now, the online, the telecommunication stuff, online stuff is federal jurisdiction. So maybe the BC Act doesn't apply to that, but it does mean that you can't march on the street saying, you know, discriminatory things.
Bringing it back to the subject of the COVID era, and I'd especially like to bring it back to your experience up there in Canada with your truckers. We had our own convoy protest here in New Zealand that was inspired by your truckers.
Yes.
And many people like to believe that our protest here had at least something to do with the ending of our mandates.
Yes.
So what about the Canadian version? Obviously, it inspired the New Zealand convoy, but what else did it achieve?
Well, it may very well have contributed to the end of some of the mandates. I wouldn't be surprised about that at all. But it did something even more important, I think, which is that I think maybe for the first time during the COVID period, the government was scared. The truckers were actually a threat to the government. Now, I don't mean that they constituted an emergency within the meaning of the Emergencies Act. That simply was not true. But they did constitute a political threat to the government, because this was the first time, really, that you had ordinary people in numbers and in an organized way dare to say to a sitting power, you know what? We don't trust you. And we do not consent to you telling us what to do. Now, for a regime that is based upon managing the people, that's a threat. And you've got to stamp that out as soon as you can, because if it starts to grow and snowball, then that is going to be the equivalent of an uprising. Which is why I think that the government chose to treat it as it did. Now, fortunately, the use of the Emergencies Act has been ruled to be unconstitutional. Well, the invocation unlawful, and then the regulations that they invoked using the Emergencies Act to be unconstitutional. But nevertheless, it was a political emergency for the government because of what it was and who they were and what they were saying. And in that respect, it was a monumental accomplishment. It was one of the few events in this country's history where ordinary people have come forward and said, no more, not doing this. I do not consent to this.
What was the support like for it across the country? We watched it through our social media channels here, but it was hard to know exactly what the popular support for it was on the ground. What was it like in Canada? How much support did it actually have?
It was very split, is my perception. I'd be hard-pressed to give you numbers. But there were an awful lot of people who were so thankful, so encouraged. I mean, there were people, as the trucks drove from one to the end of the country and the other, there were people collected on bridge overpasses over the highway, sort of waving and waving flags and shouting their support. It was quite a collection of sights. On the other hand, the truckers were also villains to an awful lot of people, including and especially a lot of residents of Ottawa. Now, it's very interesting to see the reactions to the various protests that go on in Ottawa, because the truckers were by no means the most disruptive. They might have been the longest. I mean, after all, they parked, and they were guilty of illegal parking. But that's about it, right? And some of the, you know, the reactions of the local residents was outrage. How could they do this? On the other hand, there are much more sort of violent protests in Parliament at Parliament Hill over the years, and like, you know, people don't even really care. So my theory is that it was because of the content of what they were protesting that made it outrageous. I mean, you are challenging the government's right to manage our way out of a public health emergency. Who the heck do you think you are, kind of thing. And although the complaints are not that exactly, they're complaining about, you know, the noise from the honking horns and the intimidation of local businesses, which, by the way, I never saw. I was there for most of the time. I never saw anything like that. I think what underlies all of these pretend complaints is objection to the content of the message.
So here in New Zealand, we are currently going through a royal commission of the COVID period. And when we look at the terms of reference that the government has installed in that royal commission, it seems to many that we won't actually get a true inquiry from it. But in Canada, you've already gone through an inquiry about the truckers' protest. And I believe the judge in that actually found that Justin Trudeau actually acted unlawfully in using the Emergencies Act to break the protest. Does that mean that we can have some faith in the wheels of democracy and justice? Is it a reminder to us here in New Zealand that we should actually trust the legal system?
No, I wouldn't go that far. So the trucker protests has been assessed in two different kinds of proceedings. One was a commission of inquiry, and the other was an actual courtroom. And in the, there were two. So in the courtroom, the judge, to his credit, quite rightly found that the invocation of the act was unlawful according to the criteria in the statute itself. In other words, the threshold was not met. That's the opposite conclusion that they found in the commission of inquiry, which was not a legal proceeding at all. It was an inquiry that was required in the Emergencies Act itself, but it did not have the mandate of assessing the legality of the use of the act. And it was as you would expect. I mean, it was lengthy. They had witness after witness after witness. It lasted for weeks. But it wasn't there to make a legal decision. And in the end, the judge, although he said reluctantly, concluded that the use of the act was reasonable. And then in the courtroom, after that, the judge of the federal court said that the use of the act was unlawful, which I think is easily the correct answer. So I know I would not take very much confidence in a royal commission. I don't have very much confidence in that form of investigation, whatever the topic is. Sometimes they work out fine, but often that they just don't. I mean, if there's a legal case to make, it should be made in a courtroom. And if you don't have a legal case, well, then you got to expect that it might just turn out to be political whitewashing.
One of the legal arguments that I expect our inquiry must answer is the question of how our Bill of Rights affected what went on. In Canada, you've got something very similar. You've got, I believe it's called the Charter Rights. How did these rights stand up to the pressure of the COVID era?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. The Charter was essentially useless. There were some cases brought that should have been found to violate the Charter. And, you know, the courts, for my money, you know, had to do handstands to try and avoid that conclusion. But on the other hand, there were also cases that were brought under the Charter that I didn't think had very much chance from the beginning, because they didn't really confront the actual content of the rights. Let me give you an example. So if you have a system of vaccine passports, which means you have to have a vaccine to go to a restaurant or to go into the store or to go into a government building, and you say, all right, well, that's a violation of my informed consent. Informed consent is a very central principle in our laws, and it's reflected in Section 7 of the Charter. I'm going to bring a challenge to that law under Section 7. Well, here's the thing. Your right to informed consent has not actually been violated, because you chose to go to the doctor's office or the pharmacy to get the shot, to get your passport, so you could go to the restaurant. And so you gave your consent to the doctor to get the shot. That's what informed consent means. And what's happened in this modern era is that this managerial state has found a way to get around charter rights by doing things indirectly around the back door. They never said, and they've said this over and over again, and I'm afraid they're correct. They've said, we never made you get a shot. They never did make you get a shot. What they did was say, the choice is yours, but there are consequences for the decision that you make. And if you don't have one, then we're sorry you can't go here and you can't go there and you can't go there, but we're not making you get one. And the problem is that there's nothing in our Constitution that prevents an expansive administrative state.
So that's the same problem we have here. So how do those rights become part of our constitutions?
Now you're into the problem of how to amend your constitution, and that's very difficult. It's very difficult for us. I don't think there's any prospect of that in the short term here. And even if there was, I'd be wary of it. Not because it shouldn't be changed. It really definitely needs to be changed. But the dangerous part of it is that if you open it up for change, then there are going to be many other forces on the other side of the aisle who want it changed in the other direction. And those protections that you have right now, even the ones that didn't work so well, they're at least still there in the text. If they get changed in the wrong direction, then you'll be in a worse situation than we are right now. So whenever you're opening up a constitution, you are opening up a political fight. And you better be sure before you do that it's a fight you can win.
On the subject of the law and the hits it took, we had instances here in New Zealand where the government was found to be breaking the law, so they simply went and changed it. In one case, they were found to be misusing the emergency use authorization laws for the vaccine rollout, which said that they could use the vaccines under emergency use on only a limited amount of people. And it was a very easy argument to make that a limited number of people was not everybody in New Zealand. So they lost that case, and when they did, they simply changed the law within 24 hours. So this sort of behavior really destroys a lot of people's faith in the legal system and the legislation system. How much of a hit has the faith in our legal systems taken?
Well, it very much depends upon who you're asking. Yes, for some people, it's suffered a huge hit, I think, and quite rightly so. People, I think during COVID, as the nightmare unfolded, a lot of people thought that the law would save them. You know, the law was solid. It was there for this kind of purpose. It was there in black and white. You could open the books and see what the law said. They read the charter. They have these rights. So surely this was going to be fixed. And it was not. And so on that basis alone, I think a lot of people have figured that the system, and this is a word I hear a lot, that the system is corrupted. And, you know, when I hear that and when I think it myself, when we say corruption, I'm not talking about corruption in the traditional sense of, you know, somebody's calling somebody up and saying, you know, we're going to offer you this if you decide that. That's not what I mean. I mean, it's corrupted in the sense that it's not working the way it was intended. At least, and that's only a point of view, right? For a lot of people, things were just sailing along, and the governments kept their paws out of it. They were deferential to government. And a lot of people thought that was fine. So it very much depends upon you, who you ask. If you are in favor of all the COVID measures, I think your faith in the law probably has remained unchanged. If you were a COVID skeptic, then you have no reason to believe that the next time around your laws will save you.
Okay, to sum up then on that very positive note, how do you see history marking these past few years? I suppose if you like the managerial state, as you call it, then you may be very optimistic for the future. Or if not, you know, maybe this experience and these discussions in the aftermath, perhaps from those, we now have a better idea of what freedom is or what we want from it.
Yes. Well, let's hope the latter. But if nothing else, then this era has produced division. And the problems that confront us are at least more starkly seen than they were before. I mean, they were there before COVID. And they're pretty much in the same form as they are now. They're just much more extreme now. And so COVID, in a way, speaking of silver linings, COVID has helped to bring this into relief. And we know what the dangers are now. We know what path we're on. We know the path is bad. Got to get off this path. I'm not sure that nearly as many people would have said that, you know, 4 years ago. So let's take that as a kind of bitter victory.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Inquiry Sessions today. Bruce, it's been incredible to pick your mind on all of these issues. But just before we go, how can someone find your work online?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. Yes, Rights Probe is a law and liberty think tank. It's a division of the Energy Probe Research Foundation, and all our work can be found at our website, which is Rights Probe. That's all one word, RIGHTSPROBE.org, rightsprobe.org.
That's Bruce Pardee, Executive Director of Rights Probe and a Professor of Law at Canada's Queen's University, here to share his observations of the COVID era with our Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio from a Canadian perspective. As the dust settles on the COVID era, it's clear to most of us that what we experienced here in New Zealand was eerily similar to what others experienced around the world. And I don't say that simply from a COVID virus context. I say it from observing the reactions of our governments and the legislation they passed, and even the language they used to pass off what turned out to be disastrous and overblown reactions to the COVID virus. And I suspect that those comparisons will only get more pronounced as time goes on. My name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to the Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio.
The RCR Inquiry Sessions. Unpacking the COVID response for an honest inquiry. Keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the Inquiry Sessions.